First, let me say that this recording is not just lab material. This is also lecture material. As part of it, as you'll see eventually, I'm going to give you three slides from a chapter we haven't gotten to yet. Once we're upstairs doing that chapter, I'll skip over them because I'm doing them down here instead. But this information you have to know for both the quiz and for the upcoming lecture exam. All right, now we want to talk today about transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. And there are three major categories of such transport processes. Any idea what they are?
Osmosis.
Osmosis is an example of one of the categories, but it's not the category itself. What kind of transport is osmosis, by the way? That would be the category. One is passive transport. What about another one? Does passive give you a clue? Active transport is another one. And you might have been taught at one point in grade school, maybe, high school, that those were the two. There's a third, though, which is vesicular transport. That means involving a vesicle, which is a small cell-like bag of membrane. We'll talk more about vesicular transport in lecture eventually. So that's all I'll say about that today. It's one of the categories. Active and passive are distinguished on what basis? What makes the difference between these? Any idea? Have you heard of active and passive transport before? Okay. They're distinguished on the basis of energy, but I don't want you to think that passive transport doesn't require energy. They both require energy. You can't move things for free. So they both require energy. But passive transport does not require an outside additional expenditure of energy because the energy required is already built into the system, which I'll explain in a minute. So there's no additional energy required for passive transport. Active transport, though, does require an outside source of energy. Additional energy has to be supplied, otherwise it's never going to happen. Passive transport happens on its own because there's already energy built into the system, and that energy drives it. Now, what we're going to talk about for the rest of the time is passive transport. So we'll talk more about active transport upstairs eventually. That'll be lecture-only material for the lab today. Passive transport is what we want to talk about. That's what this experiment is all about. And passive transport of particles is called diffusion. Diffusion is always passive. Now, speaking of particles, this could be in any fluid, a gas or a liquid, but today's it's liquid. The particles making up a fluid are in constant motion, right? Every individual particle is moving at its own speed and its own direction. But there are trillions and trillions of particles overall, each independently moving. And that movement is basically random. They're all just individually going at their own speed and direction. Now, if you took the average of those speeds, that would give you an indication of temperature. But they're not moving at the same speed. They're each moving independently. And randomly, as far as direction is concerned. That random movement of particles is called Brownian movement, or Brownian motion. after some dead dude named Brown. Now, diffusion, which is passive transport, is a process that is directed. It's a directed process. That means it happens in a specific direction. Even though it's caused by random motion. This Brownian motion is the random motion. So random motion somehow causes motion in a specific direction, which kind of seems contradictory. But let me hopefully explain why. If we have a container and I put some particles in there, but I lump them together in one place. That's concentrated, right? That's a concentrated region. And each of them is moving. Now we've stopped the clock for the moment. They're not moving. But they are actually moving in reality, each one at its own speed and direction. Diffusion occurs because of what is called a gradient. Gradient is a real general word that basically means a difference in values for some sort of measurement taken at one place compared to another place. There's all kinds of different gradients. A thermal gradient, for instance. You can buy thermal gradients for reptiles that will be warm at one end and cool at another end and everything in between. They choose what they want to lie on. That's a gradient. You can have a pressure gradient, which is why water comes out of the faucet, right? It's higher pressure inside than outside. So that's a difference in pressure. That's a gradient. And an AC receptacle, the two electrodes in there, are at different electrical potential energies. So there's a difference in that, which we call a voltage. That's a gradient also. All kinds of different gradients. The kind of gradient we're going to talk about today, that we're dealing with in today's experiment, is a concentration gradient. Meaning, a concentration of some sort of solute is, or some sort of particle, is different at place A than it is at place B. As long as that's true, as long as there's a difference, then you have a gradient. And I'll be repeating this many times, especially in Unit 3, but it's the first time I'm telling you this. Whatever kind of gradient it is, it's not true of just concentration gradients. A gradient in general, is a form of potential energy. It is stored energy. And therefore, it can do some work. And this is why before I said passive transport has the energy built into the system. The energy that it requires to move the particles is built into the system. Well, that energy source is a concentration gradient. If the gradient exists. If there is no gradient, meaning the concentration at A is the same as the concentration at B, that's like saying the gradient is zero. There's no difference. Or you can just say the gradient doesn't exist, either one. And therefore, diffusion won't occur. But if there is a gradient, it can occur. And it's driven by that gradient itself. All right? Now back to these particles. Just imagine that you're one of these particles in this concentrated region. Now, if you are one of these particles that are in the middle of this mass of particles, it doesn't matter which direction you happen to be moving or at what speed, you're not going to get very far, right? You're just going to knock into some other particle and then bounce off at a new direction and speed. But you're not going to escape yet. You're not going to escape that mass yet because you're in the middle of it. Now, think about the particles that form the outer layer, the periphery, the edge. some of those particles, even though they're on the edge, are going to be going in a direction that will send them toward the middle. So they're not going to get very far either. They're just going to bounce. But because they're all moving at random speeds and directions, some of those particles on the edge will be moving away, and they therefore will be able to escape. And when that happens, that leaves fewer behind, and it opens up a new periphery, a new edge, with new particles that have a chance of escaping. And so more and more will leave. You see what I'm saying? And if you come back after some time has passed, then the particles will be spread out evenly throughout the container, all bouncing over off of each other and off the walls of the container. But there won't be a gradient anymore. Right now there's a gradient because the concentration is high here, low here. That's a concentration difference and therefore a gradient. When you come back and they're all spread out more or less evenly, the concentration is the same everywhere. The gradient is at zero. So that's what diffusion, which is passive transport, is driven by, a concentration gradient. There are two requirements for net diffusion. But what I mean by net diffusion is that the particles are moving in one direction more than another. Okay? This is what I meant when I said that diffusion is a directed process. It's caused by random movement. That's what I just explained. But the movement is such that particles are always going to be moving, on average, as a whole population, from where the concentration is higher to where the concentration is lower. That's the directedness of the process. So it's caused by random movement, but it always results in movement, a net movement, from higher concentration to lower concentration. All right? Well, back to these two requirements. There's two requirements for net diffusion to occur. One is that you have to have a concentration gradient. You know, once these are all spread out, there is no tendency for them to move in one direction any more than another direction. So there's no net diffusion at that point. That's one requirement, but that's not enough. The second requirement for there to be diffusion from A, wherever that is, to B, is that the particle, whatever it is, has to be able to get from A to B. So the gradient is the tendency for the particle to go from A to B. But if it's blocked for some reason, it's not going to be able to do it. You have to, for the diffusion to actually occur, you have to have a gradient, and the particle has to be able to get from A to B. Okay, let's look at some pictures then. In this slide, we have on the top row one chamber. This is looks like three boxes, but it's the same one at three different points in time, starting with the left. And this chamber is subdivided by what's represented as a dashed line, but that dashed line represents a membrane separating the one chamber into two subchambers. And not only is it a membrane, but it's a membrane that it is able to allow certain things through the membrane and block other things. So we call such a membrane a selectively permeable membrane. Permeate as a verb means to move through. Selectively permeable, therefore, refers to the fact that certain types of things can get through, can permeate, and other things can't. They're blocked. Now, diffusion does not have to involve any membrane. Just imagine plunking a sugar cube. So they still make sugar cubes, don't they? I haven't seen one in a while. you put a sugar cube into a glass of water, right at first, there's going to be a very high concentration of sugar where the cube is, and a zero concentration of sugar around it. So that's a gradient for sugar. There's no membrane there. You have both of the requirements for diffusion fulfilled. You have a gradient in place, and you have a way for sugar to get from A to B. So if you come back later, the sugar particles are not going to still be in a cube. They're going to have diffused by then into the water. And by the way, water is also diffusing at the same time. When you put that sugar cube in there, there's a high concentration of water where the cube is not, and a low concentration of water where the cube is. So water is going to diffuse also, but in the opposite direction at the same time. That's just simple diffusion, not involving any membrane. Membranes are sometimes involved, though, like when we're dealing with cells. Cells have plasma membranes. But anyway, that's what this gray dashed line represents, a selectively permeable membrane. And in this case, it's permeable. The membrane is permeable to whatever these orange dye molecules are. They're able to get through. Notice that originally you have a gradient in place because you have a high concentration of orange dye molecules on the left, a zero concentration on the right. So that's the tendency. The gradient is the driving force. It's the tendency for there to be diffusion. But since the membrane is permeable to the orange dye molecules, you also fulfill the second requirement, which is a way to get there. And therefore, they are going to move from left to right. Now, it's not the case that every molecule is going to go from left to right. They're randomly moving. Some of them are moving right to left. But at first, there's nothing on the right side, right? So any movement has to be from left to right until you have some on the right. And the greater the difference in how many molecules there are per unit space, the greater the likelihood that some will be moving in that direction. If you wait long enough, though, it comes to equilibrium. And in this case, it attains equilibrium because the gradient is dissipated. It goes to zero. There is no more gradient here because the concentration on the left is the same as the concentration on the right. There's therefore no more tendency for net diffusion, meaning movement in one direction more than the other. Equilibrium does not mean that the particles stop moving. They're still moving. It's just equally likely for them to move right to left as it is left to right, and therefore there's no more change in concentration. On the bottom, you have exactly the same situation, but the important point being made here is that if you have two different types of particles, each individual type of particle will feature its own gradient, and only that particle's own gradient matters to that type of particle. So orange molecules have a gradient for orange molecules, and they're moving, what we say, down the gradient. Diffusion happens down a gradient. That's what that means, from high concentration to low concentration. That's the only reason orange molecules are moving the way they are. It has nothing to do with purple molecules. The purple molecules have their own gradient, and it happens to be directed in the opposite direction, right? But they're still going down their gradient from high concentration to low concentration, which for them is right side to left side. And they can both come to equilibrium. Both of the gradients have been dissipated here. Is that all clear? Okay. Now I want to give you a special case of diffusion. It's still diffusion, but we use a different word if certain conditions are met. And that special case of diffusion is called osmosis. And this involves some confusing terminology, or what I think is phrased confusingly. First of all, osmosis, as I said, is always diffusion. It's just a special case of diffusion. So it's always passive because all diffusion is always passive. Now, there are two things that have to be true for the diffusion to be the special case we call osmosis. One is that instead of solute particles that are moving, like these dye molecules that are in water, they're solutes, right? Instead of solute particles diffusing, it has to be solvent particles for it to be osmosis. And there's all kinds of solvents. So that would be what a chemistry textbook would say. Most biology books will say osmosis is water moving. Well, that's only because in biology the solvent is always water. But technically it could be any solvent. Not solute, though. That's one difference. That's a requirement, but that's not enough. For instance, back to the sugar cube example, water was diffusing, right? Water diffuses toward where the sugar is, and water is a solvent, but that's not osmosis because it doesn't fulfill the second requirement for the special case. The second requirement is that that solvent particle type, whatever it is, needs to be moving through a selectively permeable membrane. So the sugar cube example is just simple diffusion of water. It's not osmosis. But if water is diffusing through a selectively permeable membrane, then it is osmosis, which is still diffusion. It's just using a different word for that special case. Well, let's look at it in the next slide. Here you have piece of glassware called a U-tube. That's the original meaning of U-tube. A U-shaped piece of glass. And on the bottom is a selectively permeable membrane. Now, it's selectively permeable such that water can get through it, but the green molecules can't. Okay? And water is solvent. Since it can go through a membrane, that means we have osmosis possible here. Now let me talk about what I said was confusing terminology. I don't know whether you've ever read a textbook definition of osmosis before or not, but typically a biology textbook, since biology textbooks always talk about water as the solvent, will define osmosis something like this. They'll say osmosis is movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Have you ever read a definition like that? Okay, well, they exist. Anyway, that is true. It is true to say that osmosis involves movement of water from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but the reason that's confusing, or at least I think it's confusing, is that it makes it seem like an exception to what I said is true of diffusion, which is movement from high concentration to low concentration. It's not actually an exception, though. It's just a backward explanation. If water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, that's just a backwards way of saying that water is moving from a high water concentration to a low water concentration. Because if you have a low solute concentration, that means it's very watery, right? And if you have a high solute concentration, that means it's not very watery. So I think it's more direct, especially because the solutes are not what's causing the movement. It's the water gradient. It's more direct to define osmosis as movement of water or some other solvent from a high water concentration to low water concentration through a semi-permeable membrane, or selectively permeable, sorry. Okay? Well, let's look at what we have before the clock starts. Here at time zero, you have two subchambers. Since this membrane separates the two U-tube into separate chambers, you really have two different aqueous solutions. Right? They're at different concentrations. It's the same type of solution because it's the same solute in water, but different concentrations. So how many gradients are there? There's two because there's two types of particles. There's a gradient for water and there's a gradient for green particles. Each one, simply because of that gradient existing, has the tendency to diffuse. But even though green wants to go from right, where it's more concentrated, to left, where it's less, it can't get through the membrane. So, no diffusion of green particles. Water has its own gradient, though. And there's a higher water concentration on the left than there is on the right. That's the tendency. And since it can get through the selectively permeable membrane, it will. That is osmosis. Now, if you allow this to happen, when the water does osmose from left to right, you're removing water from the left chamber and you're adding water to the right without replacing anything, right? And that's why the level goes down on the left side and it goes up on the right side. Well, this thing has come to equilibrium on the right figure. And it looks like it's for the same reason that equilibrium was attained in the previous slide, because this looks like the same concentration as this, right? If the concentrations become equal, there's no more gradient, and therefore no more osmosis. That's one way that you can get to equilibrium. But actually, you have to imagine this, because I don't have a picture. There's another way it can happen. Start with exactly like you have here, except the left side is pure water. The right side is just like this picture, but the left side is pure water to start with. The gradients are still the same, right? The gradient for water is from left to right. The gradient for the green is from right to left. Green is stopped, though, so it can't get into the left chamber. So the only thing that can move is the water, and it moves from left to right. But since it's pure water here on the left, it doesn't matter how much water you remove and put it into the right side, you're still going to have pure water left behind, right? And you're never going to have pure water on the right side. You're making it more and more dilute. You see that? But you're always going to have a greater than zero concentration of green particles on the right. And so the right side is never going to be as watery as pure water. Meaning that it's impossible to eliminate the gradient. You see what I'm saying? It'll still come to equilibrium, though. Because as you move water from left to right and put it into the right column gets taller and taller. That means it gets heavier and heavier, and it's being pulled down with greater and greater force by gravity. And when the force of gravity pulling down exactly equals the opposing force trying to push it up by osmosis, then it'll come to equilibrium for that reason, even though the gradient is still in place. Any questions on osmosis? Okay, well, that's what's happening in your dishes. Each, you have billions of cells in there, in your chunks of potato, but each cell is like a little bag with a enclosed by a membrane, and so any individual cell separates the universe into two compartments, right? What's in the cell and what's outside the cell. Well, what's immediately outside the cells in an organism is also an aqueous solution. It's extracellular fluid that's outside the cell. What's inside the cell is intracellular fluid, and the membrane separates two aqueous solutions. Therefore, there's a potential for osmosis to occur, but only if the wateriness is different inside versus outside. So that brings up the next slide, which is a slide about tonicity. Tenacity is a general word referring to the tendency for osmosis to occur into or out of a cell that is surrounded by an aqueous solution. Okay? Notice, though, the headings on these three columns. There's three different categories of tenacity: hypotenicity, isotenicity, hypertenicity. Well, those are nouns. The corresponding adjectives are given: hypotonic, isotonic, hypertonic. These are also confusing definitions. They seem backwards, just like osmosis does. So let me make sense of this. The reason that they're backwards is that the prefixes, which are the only thing different about the three words, refer not to the water, which is what matters. Instead, they refer to the solutes. All right? But this confuses a lot of people, so listen carefully. Before I even give you those definitions for the three individually, this reminds me to say something about the manual. The author of the manual, which is a different instructor with her own section of 181, makes errors in the manual every now and then. Usually they're just wording errors. No big deal. But this chapter, unless she has fixed it, features an error that I need to tell you about, because I don't want you to do this. These words that I'm about to define, hypotonic, isotonic, hypertonic, they should never be used to describe a cell. And she used to do that. I don't know about this newest version. I haven't looked closely enough. You should only use these words to describe the environment that the cell is surrounded by, not the cell itself. Okay, now to the definitions. What does hypo, just as a prefix, mean? No, it means below. Like a hypodermic needle means below the skin. Hypo means lower or below. And this is the confusing part of it. The lower here refers not to the water. It refers to the solutes, even though the wateriness is what matters. A hypotonic environment or a hypotonic solution is one that has a lower, that's where the hypo comes from, a lower overall solute concentration than the intracellular fluid of the cell does. But notice that's just a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell.
So like the U2, then, like if you're going to do that, since it's the lower concentration here, that would be the one that goes down.
The lower solute concentration would go down because that means it's more watery, and water therefore moves away from that. Okay? So hypotonic always means more watery than the cell. Less solute-y. That's why it's hypo, because it refers to the solute, not the water. More watery than the cell. And that's important to keep in mind, because if osmosis occurs, it always occurs in such a way that water moves to the less watery place. It's going down its own gradient. Water moves from where it's more watery to where it's less watery, always. So if you put an animal cell, which is the top row here, we're using a red blood cell, an erythrocyte, as an example of an animal cell. We have billions of them in our body. You put one of those into a hypotonic environment, you have a gradient in place. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called hypotonic, right? Hypotonic is more watery than the cell, so there's a gradient for water. Water is always going to move to where it's less watery. In this case, less watery is in the cell. So water will go through the membrane and enter the cell. We haven't yet gotten to studying the cell and cells. We're almost there, but we haven't compared, for instance, animal and plant cells. So we'll talk more about this upstairs. But one major difference is that animal cells, like all cells, by definition, have a membrane called the plasma membrane. That's what really what defines it. But that's all they have for their boundary. Plant cells also have a plasma membrane, but external to that, they have a much thicker and sturdier cell wall. We animals don't have that on our cells. So you put an animal cell into a hypotonic environment, it's going to take in water because water is going to where it's less watery. And the flimsy, thin plasma membrane can't hold the pressure. And that's why the cell will burst, which kills the cell. That bursting is called lysis. The verb is lysed. This one has lysed. But the process is called lysis. Just like in the word hydrolysis, right? Which means splitting a big chunk into two. Lysis is splitting. The cell gets split because it ruptures. That happens to an animal cell in a hypotonic environment. Let's go to the other extreme first, hypertonic. It once again, word hyper means above, but it's referring to the solutes. So a hypertonic solution is one that has a higher overall solute concentration than the cell does, which is just a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell. Therefore, since water always moves from more watery to less watery, it's going to move, in this case, out of the cell to the less watery exterior. And therefore, the animal cell is going to shrink, shrivel. And that shriveling of an animal cell in a hypertonic environment is specifically called crenation. With an N. Crenation, not cremation. Okay, so the cell will crenate. And that also will kill it if it's severe enough. So animal cells don't do well in either extreme. Well, the iso prefix means same, like an isomer or isotope. So isotonic refers to a solution that has the same overall solute concentration as the cell does, which is just a backwards way of saying that it's equally watery compared to the cell. And to illustrate how it's true that the solutes do not really matter, and it's only the water particles that matter, consider the situation in which you have a membrane separating two, or a cell in a solution. If the cell has only one kind of solute in it, which real cells don't, but just imagine a cell containing starch like potato does. And let's just say it's one molar concentration. And the outside, you could be a one molar sucrose solution, like that you're using sugar solutions here, right? Table sugar. Those are totally different types of solutes, right? But as long as the overall solute concentration is the same inside and out, that means that they're equally watery. And it's the wateriness that matters. So if there is no water gradient, then it's an isotonic solution, and water doesn't have a tendency to go one direction more than another. It still goes into and out of the cell. It just goes in and out at the same rate. And therefore, there's no volume change in the cell as a result. So animal cells do best in an isotonic environment. And that's why a major fraction of your overall homeostasis is devoted to keeping your fluids at the right concentrations so your cells don't die. All right, now let's consider a plant cell in these three environments on the bottom. I said that the plant has a cell wall much thicker and sturdier than the cell membrane. The cell wall of a plant is like the actual structural wall of this room. And the paint on the interior surface of the wall is like the plasma membrane of the cell wall, of the plant cell. When you have a plant in a hypotonic environment, meaning watery environment, it actually does best in that situation. For the same reason as an animal cell, hypotonicity means that the water is going to come into the cell. It's going to go to where it's less watery. But because that sturdy cell wall is in place, it will hold the pressure. It's not going to kill the plant cell. It's going to make it turgid, which means nice and swollen. Now, this is just a single plant cell, but real plants have billions of cells, trillions. And so the same thing is happening simultaneously with all of them. And when you have a bunch of plant cells to get hooked together and they're all being swollen, it has the effect of causing an erection in the plant. Very similar to an erection in a penis, except a penis erection is the hydrostatic pressure is due to the fact that more blood is entering than is leaving, so it builds up. Here you have blood, or you have water coming in because of osmosis. If you give the plant water, right? When you water a houseplant, you don't give it very concentrated salt water. You give it pure water. You can't get more hypotonic than pure water. Nothing is more watery than pure water. So the water will go into the cells, and that will keep the stem erect. You know, when you see it drooping over, that means you forgot to water it. And if you get it in time, give it more water, it will go back up. So that's the ideal situation for a plant, not for an animal. A plant cell will survive isotonicity, but it won't be turgid. It'll just be flaccid, very limp. And that's when the plant will start to sag. It can survive it, it's just not ideal. If you put a plant in a hypertonic solution, it's going to lose water, the same reason the animal cell does, but it doesn't undergo crenation. We give it a different word called plasmolysis. That's the noun form of plasmolyze. And be careful with the word plasmolysis because it ends in lysis, even though it's kind of the opposite of lysis of an animal cell. Plasmolysis results when water leaving into the hypertonic environment means that the plasma membrane that directly contains that water is going to peel away from the inner lining of the cell wall. And that will kill the plant cell. So that's plasmolysis. In a plant cell will undergo plasmolysis in a hypertonic environment. An animal cell will undergo crenation, but for the same reason. Any questions on any of these terms? All right, then let me talk a little bit about the experiment explicitly. Just like this first, the saltwater one, this has specific instructions in your manual already. So when you go to writing it, and you shouldn't really, don't even start writing this until after you're done handing in and getting graded for the first one. So you can get, even though they're unrelated, you might be able to do better by seeing how you did on the first one first. Just pay attention to the due date, which I don't have memorized, but it's up there on Canvas. Anyway, just follow the instructions, but there's part of the instructions that I just want to tell you how to do because it confuses so many people. For one thing, you have to graph. You have to make a graph. What is your independent variable today? Concentration of your solution, right. Where does that go? Which axis? X-axis, horizontal axis. And what are the values? 0.3 and 0.5, so do not give me this. These are not equally spaced numbers, right? It's not like red, green, and blue. They're not categories. These are numbers. 0.3 is closer to 0.5 than it is to 0, so do that correctly. Because that'll affect your line that you draw. And therefore, it'll affect your use of that line. Make sure you have everything labeled correctly with units, as usual. But let me just fill in some fake data. Yours isn't necessarily going to look like this. Let's say it looks like that. These don't fall on a perfect line, as you'd expect, because they're real data. There's some error. But it looks like you could fit a line to them. And so let me do that. Remember, a best fit line doesn't necessarily go through any point. Anyway, on the vertical axis is your dependent variable, which is what? It's not mass. I kind of trapped you. You are directly measuring mass today, right? Well, you're weighing it to get a mass. But mass is not what you should graph here. Right, it's the change in mass. You're getting two masses for each dish, but you're using those to calculate one value called the change in mass. And what in science, what symbol do we use for the change in something? Delta, an uppercase delta, which is an equilateral triangle, a Greek D. So if you put mass as a subscript, the change in mass is what that means, is a difference. Well, mathematically, you can compute a difference two different ways, right? A minus B or B minus A. They're both differences. But there's only one proper way to do a delta calculation. It should be mass final minus mass initial, not the other way around. Here's why. If you have a final mass, which you haven't yet measured, for a dish that's bigger than it was for the initial mass, what is going to happen mathematically here? What's delta going to be? It's going to be a positive number because you have big minus small. That's still going to be positive, right? But if you have initial mass that's bigger and it goes down, then final minus initial, small minus big, it's going to be a negative number. That's why you have to do it correctly, because a negative change means that water has been lost. A positive change means water has been taken on by the cells. It's been gained. So make sure you do that correctly. Now back to the graph. Most people are used to just slapping a zero down here at the bottom of the y-axis. That's not always appropriate, and it's not appropriate here. Because, I don't know what your data are yet, but probably you're going to get either two positives and one negative, or two negatives and one positive. Very unlikely that you're going to get exactly zero for any of these. But you should be getting a positive and a negative. And so the zero should be not at the bottom. It should be somewhere in the middle. And you have positive numbers up here and negative numbers down here. Now this won't happen if you graph mass instead of change in mass. All the masses are positive, right? Change in mass can be either positive or negative. Okay, now this is the important part. This is what confuses the most people. And this is why I'm just telling you exactly what to do, but still, about half of the people don't do exactly what I do. So remember that this recording exists before you start writing this report. Listen to this before you write it. The confusing question, though, I forget how it's phrased in the manual, but you'll see it in the instructions, is that it asks you to figure out what the solute concentration of the cell is. And of course, you're not measuring that, right? You're not directly measuring that. You're not getting into the cell, counting the solute particles, and then dividing by the volume of liquid that's in the cell. But that's what you're trying to figure out. So it has to be an indirect way of getting at that. This is where the definitions I just went through for tonicity come into play. What did I say is the definition of isotonicity? The concentration of solutes is the same outside the cell as in the cell, and therefore they're equally watery, and therefore no net osmosis happens, right? So in terms of today's results, what would that mean for the delta? It would be zero. Okay? Since you can't, you're not directly measuring the potato concentration, you have to be able to figure it out based on the thing you are measuring, or the thing you know, which is the solute concentrations, right? Like I said, it's very doubtful that you'll get any one of the three be exactly zero. But you have a line fit that you make. And that line is going to go through somewhere. It's going to cross the zero line somewhere. Well, what does that zero point mean? It means no change in mass. And the only way that can happen is if that particular concentration of the environment is the same as in the cell, which is what you're trying to find out. So here you use interpolation, like we've already learned. Specifically, you go, you find zero on the y-axis, wherever you have it labeled, go straight over until it hits your line of best fit, and then go straight down to the x-axis and read that particular concentration. If that concentration is true in the environment, that would mean zero change in the cell. And therefore, the cell itself must have the same concentration. That answers the question. Does everyone follow that logic? You sure? Okay, then do it that way to get credit. Now, speaking of credit, this is a rare opportunity. There's not many opportunities for extra credit in this course, but this is one of them. So in the remaining time, you'll be done getting your measurements almost immediately. That's just a matter of weighing them. But that doesn't mean you're completely done. One thing is, well, make sure everyone has the data before you leave. But you also need, if you want bonus points, to make a little whiteboard drawing. The whiteboards are over here. You should use three different colors. Divide it into three and draw one cell in each of the three situations. One for for all three tonicities. Okay? And just show me what happens. You need to draw me a key. You need to use three different kinds of symbols because there's three particles involved. What are the particle types? Water is one.
Solute or the sugar?
Sugar, sucrose, is another. What's the third particle? What particles are in it primarily? Starch, yes. So those are your three symbols that you need to hit. One symbol for water, one for sucrose, one for starch. Okay, now each cell, each potato cell, has a bunch of starch in it, but the starch, even though it wants to get out, can't. It's too big. So the starch is only in the potatoes. This is how you draw it. Sucrose, well, there's no sucrose in the zero. But the point two, there's sucrose on the outside, would like to get in but can't get in. So draw it outside only for the point two, point three, and point five. And then in all three, there's water both in and outside. But you need to draw it in such a way that you can show for hypotonic that there's a lot more water outside than inside, and so on. Label each one as either hypotonic, isotonic, or hypertonic, and use arrows to indicate which way or both water is moving. All right? If you have all that, show it to me before you leave, and I'll okay it or tell you how to modify it And then once I do okay it, make sure everyone gets a picture of it before you erase it. And then when you finally write your report, which has to be one Word document, insert that picture into it and you'll get bonus points. I'm almost done talking, but another thing that confuses people sometimes is that part of the things you're supposed to look at as you'll read through your manual, you'll see, are these dishes. Well, there's dishes with raisins, dishes with strawberries. Yes, there are two dishes here, but you have to pretend that this is one dish before and after. That's why they're labeled before and after, but a lot of people do not get that for some reason. So this is before something was added to the environment. This is the same dish later. Just make sense of that when you get to that part. It's not something you're writing up in the manual, I mean in the report, but it's something you're supposed to be doing today, looking at it. Other than that, just make sure you clean up the potato mess if you made any, because it'll be starchy as hell if the surface gets wet. As far as getting rid of your potatoes after you've properly shaken them off and gotten, make sure you're zeroing your scales first. But anyway, to get rid of the potatoes, just put them in the regular trash after you've gotten rid of the water. Don't put any potatoes in the sinks, though. That's it.